This is Susie Asher, Depth, Psychology, and Art, the work of Henry James, tape 1 of 2.
Let me get closer. My strategy is to give you some details of Henry James in the outer world. Are we picking up now? Okay. Dates of his life and major writing, just to place him for a few minutes in the historical context. Then I want to introduce you to a wonderful passage in a letter that he wrote to Edith Wharton about the deeper, darker, unapparent life and the whole question of the relation between the conscious and the unconscious. So we have an anchor around this issue in the inner life. Then I'm going to take you through a series of slides. It's again going to be a spiral path. Images of the family, of his brother, of some of the art. Hold those images in our mind. Then we're going to look at the dreams more carefully. And this, once we get into the dreams, which really in a seminar basis, I'm going to spill out in the beginning to get us going. And then we all have the dream texts with us, the two early dreams, the nightmare, the vision of his father and one of his older brother, Williams. So we'll have 5 dream texts to work with and all be on the same footing. And I'm very much going to ask you questions about what you think. We can play with themes that come out of that discussion, and that may well take us through a good part of the morning. My suggestion for the afternoon, again to rev us up into the fiction, is that I will tell you a little bit about the last of the Valerii story. I don't know how much you've read, and in a minute I'm going to ask you where you are in James's world. But again, my general operating procedure would be to introduce you to these issues of the conscious and unconscious by dealing with that story in a didactic manner, kind of giving you my approach to his fiction. And then taking the Jolly Corner, whether you've read it or not, taking you through it and looking at issues of the unconscious and the shadow. Again, by reading some paragraphs to you so you have the primary material in front of you, and asking for your reaction so that you can chart the subtle changes in the character's relation to this alter ego figure that he stalks and conjures up in the house on the Jolly Corner. What's wonderful about these two stories is in the first story there's a woman character, the wife, the countess of the count, who actually starts excavations in an Italian village. And in the process, a statue of Juno is found. This is the last of the Valerii. And that triggers a whole reaction on the husband's part, actually a pagan worship. The statue is finally buried again, and we're going to deal with what all that means and the dichotomies in the story. But what happens in that story is not enough in the sense that James doesn't have a way of bringing the characters or us in relation to what has been deeply buried. The choice in the story, it seems to be, is either bury, repress what's been long in the earth, the Juno, what she represents, or bring it out and let the count fall into an obsessive worship. I mean, those are not choices that we, I think, would consider acceptable. So the question is, what's the middle path between repression and obsession with this unconscious material? And in fact, in this early story from 1874, there is no middle path. But there is a woman character who's pivotal in the sense that she's placed in the possible position to be the bridge. But James at that point can't carry it off. What's interesting is when we get to the Jolly Corner in the early part of the 20th century, and I think it's the last ghost story he writes, there is a woman character who can bridge and relate to the unconscious figure in a way which is supportive for the male character who's searching, and in a way which gives us another alternative to dealing with the unconscious material. And Alice's relationship is one of acceptance to this ghostly figure that frightens the hell out of Bryden, and, matter of fact, causes him to faint. So what we're going to do then is take 2 short stories in some detail, look at one which sets up the either-or alternative between repression and obsession and doesn't quite bring off a middle way. In a later story, which sets up the same issues toward the appalling other, but has a feminine voice that provides for us a kind of acceptance and a way to deal with the unconscious. So that's what I have in mind in terms of the frame and the organization of today. Historical, into the deep stuff, visual, into the dreams, into the stories. Doesn't mean we can't change direction. I have mounds of material to play with. And we can pick and choose as we go. But that's what I think I will start with. I want to check in with you for just a moment before we take off on this path to see if you have particular questions about James. I mean, just so I can keep them in mind as I go through particular interests, biases, whatever's. And if you let me know your name as we go around the room too, that would help. So I'm not trying to test you. I'm just checking in with you to see where you are. So, Carl, would you like to start?
Well, I'm really familiar. So
good. New territory.
New territory, and that's why so far I'm fine.
Okay, great. We hope we don't lose you along the way.
I'm Paul. I know a little bit of the history of the
I'm fascinated by William and the dynamics between the brothers, and we can perhaps go.
I don't know where I found out.
William's 15 months older than Henry. He's the firstborn of five. We'll look at some pictures. William, as you may know, started out as a psychologist at Harvard, was teaching the first laboratory psychology in this country, wrote the Principles of Psychology, a huge volume, very important historically in American psychology, went on into more philosophy. The whole idea of pragmatism comes out of William James. And one of the later books and fascinating books for me is The Variety of Religious Experience, which is the book in which we'll find his dream daylight vision, even though he disguises it in the form of another character. So we are going to deal with William, and we could deal more with him if that comes up.
And your... And I don't know much about it. I tried to get into the story last night, and it was too late, or maybe too early, and it didn't get into it. What I'm interested in, and you mentioned yesterday, was the interaction between the personal relationship, and it was so isolated. And I find that I've never had much to do with that, but I've really been an analysis of the impact in my life, but I think it's all self care. Changing the role and taking it away from the relationship. Mm. So I'm expecting to learn
something. I'm trying to get back and think about it. Well, as a young man in his 20s, James really made the commitment to marry his muse. And you will see in early stories conflicts between life and art. If you live life fully, you can't really be an artist. I think he woke up to the limitations of that opposition later in his life, in his mid-50s, as he started opening up to some relationships with younger men. And that's an interesting dynamic. He was fiercely social in his life. And there are notebooks that list hundreds of dinners that he would go to in the evening. He was out in the world in many ways, collecting stories and enjoying relationships. But he was very protected from deep, intimate relationships, and we're glad that he broke through what Adele calls kind of plate glass that was between him and deeper relationships. What those relationships meant to him, because they weren't totally intimate, they weren't physical, is still a little hard to say. But there's certainly, as far as I read James, this pull toward relationship and fear of relationship. And he had that very much in relation to William. The desire to be close, to get approval from William, and William was very critical. Yes, and he felt it in... Exactly. Most of your art has to be done alone, but then there's the rest of life. Hopefully you don't have to be alone. But that is a central issue, and I think we also, as Adele said, the work puts us on the couch. I think we bring our issues to the work, and then there's the process of separating out what's really our issue and what's the issue of the writer or the artist. And Adele advises that if you're going to do psychological criticism, you better be pretty well analyzed so you can make that separation. Louise?
I'm Louise, and I'm not Paul. I'm not sure if I'm getting
Good. You can speak up.
Hi, Michael. I don't really have a question at this time. I don't get a chance to go to the job getting from my workout, but I'd like to, and I'll take anything from the longer time.
And I happen to be the lucky one.
I wondered myself last night. I went to, what am I doing here? I really wanted to take on Henry James when I had to make things going on in my life and kind of old game that I don't know. Why not? You know, I'll just be here, and I'm curious about the some areas of you talked about his depression, mm-hmm. and how do you think that he came out of the depression, and I wonder if was coming out of the depression or just the acceptance of the depression about his life and more on that point of view. And I was concerned about that. I'm curious about some of those areas of the depression and the doctoral obsession and all those topics.
Well, during that 1910 depression, he was so depressed that it was hard for him to work. And like many artists, they can work themselves out of depression. It was a combination of personal factors and returning to work again, which for him at that time was the autobiography. So the autobiography really was therapeutic. And when he went into that depression at 1910, he'd written all his major fiction. The autobiography and working on some unfinished novels was really what was left to him to do at that time, in a way to coming to terms with his own life. We can talk more about that, too. Is it June or Julia? Judy. So this is new territory. Great.
And Bunny. And I've read some of the years, but I just finished the lady in class. Mm. Doing that, I read a couple of letters. Commentaries on Hume's words, talking about how he treats women. Mm-hmm. And I think very interesting, and that's because I thought about that. The interesting thing to me about Henry James is I think he has inspired more literary criticism than practically any other English author. You go to the library, there are rows and rows of books on his, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out his way and what motivated him. His style is perfectly unique. He uses at least 50 words for every one. I think his dialogue is particularly brilliant, and I'm sure that's because he spent his life in drawing them and dinners.
Mm-hmm.
And he moved in that upper middle class society all the time. I think I read part of the writings of religious experience of 40 years ago. And I'm interested in the dynamics between the books because Henry spent so much of his time in Europe, and I think William didn't, because he always lived in America.
Traveled a bit, but he lived primarily here.
But
you might enjoy Yazelle's book called The Late Style of Henry James, talking about the late style. I forgot to mention one of the classic critics who recently died is Dorothea Crook. I don't know if you knew her because she lived in Israel for many years. She, again, one of the fine James critics. Henry James started dictating novels to a person who sat at the typewriter and typed away in the late 90s, in the middle of writing What Maisie Knew. He was getting cramps. I mean, he writes, there are over 10,000 letters of James. I mean, tremendous correspondent. A couple of hundred short stories, major novels. Writing was his life. And in the mid-90s, he was really having troubles. And the typewriters were new. And he didn't enjoy dictating to a stenographer because it took too long to get it transcribed and come back to him. And so he started working with a typist. And then he couldn't work without the sound of the typewriter. And interestingly enough, you wonder how he could have talked this style out, but he was in fact talking it out as it was being written. Interesting. I mean, his commitment to words and language is tremendous. Well, I certainly have, thank you, a way of orienting myself this morning to where you are. Let me give you, is my volume okay? Can you hear? Okay, if I start... Oh, good. If I start to drop, just crank me up again. Henry was born in 1843 in Washington Place in New York City. He was the second of five children, and we'll see William Henry, the two younger brothers, and Alice James. William Henry and Alice are the most famous, of course. Alice is famous by virtue of being an invalid most of her life and dying of cancer, and leading the life as some number of 19th century American women did, without another way to live except by being ill. There was no place, as Henry wrote, for a woman in that family. No place to be a bright, young, aspiring woman. So if you're interested in women's issues, looking at the family dynamics from that point of view can be quite amazing. The two younger brothers, there's a biography about them called The Lives of Broken Fortunes. And they had the peak of their experience in the Civil War. And really, after that, could not make it in a business sense, in a family sense. One was an alcoholic. They both died young. Very sad in that sense that Henry and William received most of the parental attention. And they were raised primarily like twins. So a lot of doing the same thing. Then the other three didn't get as much from the parents. And the parents are characterized, and I'll give you just thumbnail sketches. The father was quite an eccentric, a philosopher, independently wealthy. And the most exciting book, I think, on the whole family is the one I mentioned the other night, last night, Howard Feinstein's Becoming William James, because it goes back to the grandfather, James of Albany, and the inheritance and the arguments about wills and vocation and what the son or the first son should be doing. It is a classically enmeshed family with two geniuses and two and a half geniuses and two and a half failures, depending on how you want to look at it. The father was very soft, emotional, not very strong. He had a philosophy of not wanting the children to be committed to anything but living. He took them abroad, yanked them from one school to another, a lot of traveling, a lot of European experience in the beginning. So they weren't really rooted. I mean, there are pluses and minuses to all of this. He hobnobbed with the transcendentalists, with the Victorians in England. He was a real intellectual. He got turned on to the Swedenborg religion, which we'll talk about a little bit in relation to this dream, this crisis in his life. He wrote books and pages of material that very few people could understand. Howells, William Dean Howells, had a wonderful line about him because one of his books was called The Secret of Swedenborg Religion, and Howells said he kept it. You know, he wrote immense amounts, but he didn't communicate. And so you have an attempt to communicate, but a kind of subversion, not consciously, but this is what Feinstein talks about. Feinstein is also a psychoanalyst as well as a historian at Cornell. The father is a very potent intellectual in some ways, but very impotent in other ways. The mother, Mary James, is really the kind of ramrod strength of the family. Father couldn't leave home without getting homesick. Mary was the core of the family in some ways. But she was also a very anxious woman, and her anxieties in some ways were passed on to the children. Illness plays a very interesting function in that family. If you were ill, it was a way of getting attention. It was a way of getting out of work. It was a way of going to Europe and not feeling guilty about traveling. It was a way of getting mother's attention, but also her anxiety sort of displaced into something physical rather than emotional. You have a very odd, we should say, dynamic working in this family. William doesn't marry until his 30s. He has a depression which is suicidal because he is in such great conflict over his vocation. These are primarily issues with the father. He got most of the pressure from the father in terms of being the kind of son father wanted him to be, which was a scientist. He was an artist of tremendous talent. He studied with William Morris Hunt at Newport. You'll see his self-portrait that he drew. So the conflicts in William, the son, are parallel to some of the conflicts in Henry, the father, coming down several generations. Henry is the second child, the complacent child, the angel, the one who pleases mother, and was smart enough to move to Europe in his mid-20s to put an ocean between himself and his family, to individuate by becoming an artist and choosing his own vocation, which was his choice and not an approved choice of the family. He also found his slot before William did, many years before William did, before William went into his profession and became known. Later in life, when Henry was nominated to the American Academy of Letters, William was nominated second. And when William was nominated, he wrote a letter to the Academy declining. And it's a letter that shows some real issues of rivalry between the brothers. My vainer and something brother got in before I did, but I think you have enough Jameses in the society. He refused. I mean, there are a lot of undercurrents in these relationships that, as you get into the dynamics, I think become quite fascinating. So I would send you to Feinstein's Becoming William James, to Leon Edel's biography, now in one volume called Life of Henry James, to some other articles by James Anderson and Clifton Reed, if you want those references, where we're looking at the family from the point of view of Kohut and some of these other interesting dynamics. That's just to give you an idea of the complexity that's behind this family. As I mentioned, the boys were really brought up primarily in Europe. The first visit that James makes, Henry makes, is in 1855. They're in Europe often on 1855 to 1858. Then they go back in 1859. They come back, and both Henry and William study art in Newport from 1860 to 1861. This is the Civil War time. William does not go into the war. I've forgotten exactly why. Henry has an accident around this time. It's called in the books the obscure hurt because Henry doesn't identify what it is. Later research seems to indicate back trouble. It was enough to knock him out of the war. His father, I forgot to tell you, had one leg amputated in a fire accident as a young child. So you're dealing with a father with an amputated leg. Now, the Freudians have great fun with that image because of the impotence, the amputation. Then you get into castration anxiety as what is central to Henry's dynamic. It's not the route I follow, but there is evidence in the family that one could say that there are problems with the father. William goes to law school at Harvard. Henry follows him for a year. Henry's also followed William into Hunt's studio to study art, but it is not his talent. Harvard Law School is not for him. It gives him a cover, so to speak, to read what he wants to read. Henry makes his first trip to Europe alone in 1869 and 1870. He started to write reviews for newspapers, book reviews. He travels again to Europe with Alice. He returns to New York. His first novel that's published is called Roderick Hudson, and it happens to be about an artist. That's published in 1876. I'm going to just read you titles and dates because some of these may be familiar. It'll give you just some catchwords. 1877, he publishes The American. I'm not reading everything he publishes. 1879, the famous short story Daisy Miller, which makes him quite popular. This is the young American, a classic figure in James's fiction. who goes abroad, who's not as conscious of all the social manners, and in fact dies because she catches the plague, because she's gone out in a way and transgressed social boundaries, and symbolically that's what happens to her. Now the story's more complicated, and I'm not going to get into all the details, but that young, vigorous American girl who's not quite aware of the complexities of the European community is one of the themes, one of the international themes James picks up. The Portrait of a Lady, which is considered his first classic novel, is published in 1881. He publishes two what are called middle novels in 1886, The Bostonians and The Princess Casamassimus. These have much more overtly social concerns. He publishes The Tragic Muse in 1890. He goes into the theater in the late 90s, and Guy Domville closes in 1895. That's a very traumatic episode for him. Part of the reason I'm mentioning these things is if you want to come back to something, we can. I'm just trying to give you a kind of frame. He publishes The Awkward Age in 1899, The Sacred Fount, which is a very experimental novel, in 1901, The Wings of the Dove, which is his second major novel, as they're called, the major phase, in 1902, Wings of the Dove, The Ambassador, and The Golden Bowl are what are called the three novels of the major phase. That's The Wings of the Dove in 1902, The Ambassadors in 1903, The Golden Bowl in 1904. He lectures and comes back to the United States in 1905. He's been living in England for 20-some years, 30-some years. He works on the New York edition, which is published in 1907. When he does that, he revises everything that goes into the New York edition, which is 24 volumes, I believe. So he's going through all his early work both to select and revise. And those revisions are interesting to study for scholars because you can see what's come into his work after he's broken open in some relationships in his life. So his autobiography, the first volume, is written and published, written around 1911 and 12, published in 1913. So the American Scene is a collection of essays he writes after traveling to the United States. That's published in 1907. So 1910 is the date of the dream. He's really published all of his work, except for the work on the autobiography and on two unfinished novels. So you see how late we are in his career. He spans the years from 1843 to 1916. He takes on British citizenship just actually before he dies. First World War has already broken out. He's very upset that the United States hasn't entered the war. He has been living at Lamb House in Rye on the English coast. During the war, it's a war zone. And as a resident alien, he has to register to get back to his own house. And that for him precipitates a feeling that comes out in a very political gesture, that I feel loyal to England, I'm committed to their cause, I'm going to become an English citizen. And he's then awarded one of the highest honors for the British subjects. That stirred thoughts in America and has been somewhat controversial. Is James American? Is he English? So that gives you some sense, if you didn't know the weight of this man, a major American author, one of the most critiqued writers in our whole canon. He was also a major literary critic because he's publishing reviews in all kinds of the contemporary journals on plays and paintings and novelists. And those reviews have been collected. He writes an early study of Hawthorne, who's a major influence in his life. So in writing the prefaces for the New York edition, he also explains his whole approach, how a seed for a story came into being, how he changed it, what emphasis he would place on the story. If you take the prefaces all together, which have been collected in a book called The Art of the Novel, you have a whole philosophy of fiction. So he was really one of the first major American literary critics to have articulated a whole approach to fiction. And in fact, not surprisingly, his approach is very psychological. What he says is what counts is our experience of what happens to us as social creatures. He's not interested in the plot. in the action out there. It's in the awakening, the coming to consciousness. Dorothea Crook's book is called The Ordeal of Consciousness. It's like the ordeal of individuation. It's not easy. So you can watch those transformations, the learning on the part of the character, in any of his fiction, because that's what he's primarily interested in. And frequently he puts the story in the mind of the narrator. So you not only have one character coming to consciousness, the main character, but you have a narrator struggling with that process, trying to understand the character coming to consciousness. It makes the story refracted through the narrator much more complicated, but also more interesting. And what you find in The Turn of the Screw, one of his probably most famous short stories, ghost stories, is a narrator, the governess, who is totally unreliable. She's the one who sees the ghosts. And you have critical literature that is miles long about whether there's any validity to what she says, or is it a hallucination. And so you develop in James not only this narrator stance on the story, which leads to all these complexities, but then you get in the introduction of an unreliable narrator, and it makes you wonder, how do you make your way through these things? So you can probably see the complexity that he was drawn to because of the tremendous interest in the psychological material. You don't get a straight shot at it. And so in the fiction, he's kind of laying that out for you and forcing you to struggle through the narrator's and the character's struggle with what life is all about. Do you have any questions at this point? I am just trying to lay out a field for you. Major American writer, contributed tremendously to the development of the psychological novel, major American critic, major correspondent, volumes of letters, multiple relationships, but not that many very deep or what we would call intimate relationships. His primary intimacy was with his art. Very well recognized in the early years, Daisy Miller made him quite popular. Many of his novels were serialized in publications in magazines. Later in his life, not as popular because he was getting richer and more dense, but always considered the master. Critically, very highly appreciated. But as that often happens, the reading public gets smaller. And so when we meet him in 1910, at the end of his life, he has all of that prestige of a major artist, but not very much of a public in the terms of the popularity that he, in fact, sought on the stage. One reason he tried to write for the stage, Bernard Shaw is writing at this time, Oscar Wilde is writing at this time, was that he wanted some of that popularity that he had tasted with Daisy Miller. But it was not his medium. And yet, that experience in writing for the stage was very influential in his later writing fiction. Okay, that's a little bit of the outer world. Yes, and there are a handful of his plays. Leon Adele has just released a new edition of the plays. It is a difficult play. It's very much James' complex dialogue. It doesn't make it as a play. It's a fascinating piece of study about James. I saw another play of his in London, and of course I just ate it up, being a Jamesian. You love it. Yeah, if you're comparing it to what you more or less expect in English theater, it's too much in the head. It's too much dialogue. It's not crisp enough. The BBC television has done wonderful adaptations of James, of The Golden Bowl, of the Spoils of Poynion. There have been two operas from Henry James, The Turn of the Screw and The Aspirin Papers. There's a wonderful movie, you should rent it, The Europeans with Lee Remick, that was filmed in America. That's one of his early novels, beautifully done, exquisitely done. And there have been other plays that have come out of James. He would have relished, I think, the television versions because they are really true to his... Pardon me? I don't remember a lot of actors' names, so it could well be. Bostonians also as a movie, that's right. Beautifully, beautifully done films. We could, I would suggest taking them out. So there is a way for James to get to the popular audience. And it, of course, is a field day for scholars. I want to read you a short quotation from a letter he wrote Edith Wharton. Edith Wharton was a number of years younger than Henry James and approached him, and they met and they became very good friends. Edith Wharton often took him on motor trips driving, and he sometimes called her the devastating angel. Edith Wharton was very unhappily married to Teddy Wharton, and later in life had a very tumultuous, passionate relationship with Morton Fullerton. James knew Morton Fullerton. All of a sudden, James is in the middle of Edith's intimacies, and she writes Henry very upset about what's going on with this relationship with this younger man and not knowing what to do with Teddy. And James responds to her distress and writes to Edith, "Only sit tight yourself and go through the movements of life. That keeps up our connection with life. I mean of the immediate and apparent life, behind which all the while the deeper and darker and the unapparent in which things really happen to us learns under that hygiene to stay in its place. Let it get out of place and it swamps the scene, besides which its place, God knows, is enough for it. Live it all through every inch of it. Out of it something valuable will come. But live it ever so quietly, waitingly." So here Henry is drawing a distinction between the immediate and apparent life, what we live on a daily basis, and encouraging Edith to stay in that modality. In contrast to what he calls the deeper, darker, unapparent, in which things really, and he underlines really, happen to us. So you've got the contrast between the conscious and the unconscious, the daily life, the disruptive emergence of what is unapparent and darker. He's telling you where things happen to us in the darker place. But there's something very interesting going on in this letter. Can you tell where his sort of, how would you say, allegiance is, where he would hope to keep the balance? He says, "The unapparent in which things really happen to us learns under that hygiene of doing things in the daily world to stay in its place." There's a little hope here that maybe the unapparent, the dark stuff, the Dionysian stuff won't get out of control if we just keep moving through life. So there's a real Apollonian allegiance in James of keeping order to things. And yet he values and knows what's underneath is where it really happens to us. And it's this tension which I think makes his writing so interesting. And it's sometimes so frustrating because it's frequently the control of the texture of the text, the style, that's so intricate to hold up what's so disruptive from underneath. And of course he says if that other stuff gets out of its place, it will swamp the scene. But it's a very interesting dynamic in James. He knows where the potency is, but he certainly wants to maintain his balance. It's interesting, when he was writing about a famous actor at his time, he was also showing a preference for actors who are disciplined, controlled, reined in, and yet capable of abundant consciousness. Again, the very Apollonian. He admired this actor for his command of the effects that lie entirely in self-possession, effects of low tone, indications of inward things. So he admires that control that is yet connected to something underneath, but perfectly in balance. And he compares Coquelin's art to that of a tightrope walker and notes that his skill is a defiance of the loss of balance under exhilaration. see how important that balancing act is for James, and to stay just tipped to the side of restraint, reined in, control. You see what's happening here? His aesthetic really goes through so much. That's true. Our psyches are of one piece. When he looks at the actor, when he looks at art, he's appreciating some of the same things. So that's just a clue in another way into that inner dynamic, that issue of balance and control. So I thought we'd just take a look at some of the slides and let pictures of his family, some of the art, soak in. We'll stretch and then we'll go into the dreams. How's the pace? Okay. Should we just turn the slide projector on? And actually, we can see fairly well despite the lights. Thank you. Does that need to be turned? This is probably pretty light, but there you go. Can you see? The lights might help. Maybe I should look from back here and I can see better. Oh, that's better from here already. Henry's on the left. William is on the right. Henry's... that side, left. My left, William, is on the right. We're going to see them again.
William has the beard.
William has the beard. Henry's a little chubbier. Tremendous intensity in the eyes. Do you want to play with these images and what you read into the character from? Freud and William met when Freud came over for the Clark Lectures. And Freud was quite impressed with William's presence, even though William was quite sick at the time, and there was an appreciation of the two men. William appreciated what Freud was bringing in, even though, you know, William's psychology develops into behaviorism, which is the other side of the Freudian. And there are jokes that Henry was the better psychologist and William was the better writer. I mean, there are interesting reversals there. This is Edith Wharton on the right and Henry. My good friend Lyle Powers just edited the letters of Henry James and Edith Wharton. Makes for very interesting reading. This is William again.
Older.
15 months older. And dies in 1910 before Henry does. This is the young William. He was very much out in the world in the way Henry did not feel comfortable. In some senses, if you read the autobiography, particularly the first volume, when they're very, very young, they're 12 and 13 when they go to the Louvre in 1855, you will see Henry identifying himself as the sensitive artist who's overwhelmed by impressions. And William is one of the guys. He can go to school and kick balls and swear and play with the boys. Later in life, Henry is out socially very, very much so, and actually recognized and accomplished earlier than William found his place in the world. But if you see the boys through the eyes of the autobiography, you get this real polarization between the active, assertive young man who is William, and the inner, observing, artistic, vulnerable young boy who is Henry. I'm suggesting it's somewhat of a false dichotomy, because Henry was also rode horseback in Italy, was very social, was very artistic, was more introverted. But William was also very contemplative. As I said, he went into a suicidal depression before he made his choice of vocations. So the split that we get in the autobiography is not true to life, but it's certainly true to something going on in James's psyche that is very interesting to observe, the fact that the active and the passive are so dichotomized, and that he projects onto William so many of the qualities he didn't see or take on in himself. This is one of the reasons critics have said the intruder in Henry's nightmare is William. He's what he was not, aggressive, assertive. But I'm trying to suggest to you it was a false dichotomy, and yet it had some impact on how he thought of himself. Because he did, more than he was willing to admit, and William had more of the other side, the artistic side, than the dichotomy suggests.
So it's less, you're saying it's less the rivalry, say, the internal stuff.
It's more the internal than the external reality, although there are hooks to hang those projections on. This is William's self-portrait. He was a very accomplished artist and wanted to be an artist. But again, the feeling of intensity in that. Feinstein does a brilliant job analyzing some of William's drawings around the time of the suicidal depression. You know, if we wanted to flip through, we can get to that. As you can see, the seminar can go in many different directions. This is the father, Henry Sr. It's father. This is Mary, the mother. The two younger brothers. Robertson and Wilkie. Garth Williams and Mrs. Alice. This is in 1873. Pardon me? No, this is Alice James, the fifth child, the only daughter in the family.
She was the youngest. When you earlier you said, how many people? Four and a half or five?
Well, geniuses, they're two and a half. I'm counting her half genius and half failure. I was playing with those terms because she really took to her bed to lead her life. She eventually developed cancer. She's famous because of the diary that she wrote that has been edited. There's a biography out about her. An interesting figure in terms of many young women who did not have men because they were killed in the Civil War and who did not have a place in the family because all of the energy was directed to the boy geniuses. Who did not have a niche in the culture because, you know, single women couldn't be bright and autonomous at that time?
Well, if the woman that in the story that was finally able to speak for the other side
is Alice.
Somebody ought to explore that. Somewhere.
Yes, and William married a woman named Alice.
Okay.
And Henry was very supportive of Sister Alice, gave her money. When she was, a few years before she actually died, invited her to England with her companion, so they lived in London, and he was really the caretaking brother. They had a very close emotional connection. This is Alice in bed. I'm sorry, that's backwards. Oh, it's too dark, I think, to see. I can pass the book around. These are too dark. This is in Feinstein's book. These are images of the family from several generations, but they're too dark. Well, many do. That's the way she's remembered more than anything else. I'll give you the book. You can flip through those. This is one of William's drawings. Again, we saw that last night. This image of fear. This is Delacroix, a self-portrait. Interestingly enough, you'll see how interwoven this material is. Delacroix was William James's favorite artist. And when he went to Europe, he copied Delacroix's art.
Was Delacroix alive at that time?
Alive at that time, did you
say?
Yeah, well, Delacroix unveiled the mural in the Gallery of Apollo in 1851. We can check in a minute when he dies. I've forgotten.
But
in this...
In
Delacroix? I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up. This is a little hard to see, but I also have this in a book. This is The Death of Sardanapalus. It's too much in shadow.
This is Delacroix, too.
I'll take it out of the book for you, because this also I have in the book. It's Delacroix. This is the bark of Dante, the raft of Dante. Dante is standing up with his guide, Virgil, in a boat. And these bodies, these naked bodies, are clinging on to the boat.
Can you say just a few words about Delacroix?
Mm-hmm. And I'll do it when I have the book in hand.
Dante is on red.
Yes, and Virgil is next to him, I think, in the cloak. They are crossing the River Styx, and this is from the Inferno. And these bodies, these naked bodies, are clinging on to the raft. Some of the one on the left is biting the wood on the ship. And Feinstein talks about this image, which I, again, will show you in a book, as expressive of this biting rage that William must have felt toward his father and could not express. So it's no wonder that Delacroix is William's favorite artist, and this particular painting was the most influential in terms of William. Here's that detail.
Mm-hmm. Now, crossing the River Styx, that to be from the mythological river.
Right, under in the underworld, marking the boundary to the realm of the dead, Hades territory. And what's interesting in the Inferno, and I want to go back to this for more details, but Dante could only be guided so far by Virgil, by the voice of reason. And then he has to find another guide on his journey. And the next guide, I believe, is Beatrice. And so we're getting in. And here, again, if you want to look at this issue between the control, the intellectual, cognitive hold on life, in the boat are figures of that artistic reason, going across the sea of tremendous turbulence and emotional upheaval. Delacroix, in picking out this particular point in the Inferno, is saying that will hold you only so far, or take you only so far. But at this moment, it is what is carrying him across. These are a couple of more images of Delacroix, just to let you know that the Romantics were quite taken by this theme of the boat crossing the sea. And of course, all of the associations to the turbulence of the sea and the waters and the unconscious, and the boat being that small, man-made, this is Christ in the Sea of Galilee, bark container to carry us through. One could do a whole lecture on this theme in art. And this is the Gallery of Apollo ceiling again. The watery domain where Python is so very, very dark. But the turbulence in the painting is carried throughout with the clouds, the color, the motion of the bodies. Again, I have some of these images in the book so you can hold on to them and see them. And this is the Jericho again. Jericho did many, many studies for this painting. This was really his masterwork of his life. And Delacroix was quite influenced by Jericho. This is the brooding figure that Delacroix was the model for. That romantic feeling which goes through this painting is kind of captured in this detail, despite all of those grisly, realistic, historical details. That's it for these slides, and what I'll do is let you pass these books around. There's one more image I want to leave you with. Oh, keep the fence. Okay. There's one more image I want to pass around. When James was in the Louvre, he was struck by a painter called Paul de la Roche. Paul de la Roche was a historically very polished painter. And this is, and I'll pass this around, this is the image of the children of Edward IV in the Tower of London, just before they're about to be killed by the king who is to become Richard III. So it's a very dramatic scene that is depicted. You can play with this image in wonderful ways. There are two brothers, an older one and a younger one. In this case, it's the older one who looks a little more sickly than the younger one. The younger one who's on alert, sensing something about to happen. The dog more appreciative of something outside the door. The appalling other that's not seen, but a sense of its coming. James wrote in again his prefaces to the volumes of the New York edition, how ghosts are far more scary if you don't see them. Once they've taken shape, kind of dispel, their power. Well, how true that is psychologically speaking. So that's why James is so much fun to work with from a psychological point of view. And why this, interestingly enough, this picture captured Henry's imagination at the time that William was taken by the bark of Dante. Henry's already caught up in brother stuff and the appalling other that's outside the door and unseen. So if you want to take a closer look to that, de la Roche was very, very polished historically in the detail of capturing the velvet and the dress and this and that. If you want to have a clearer image of the Jericho, it's in here. The Delacroix's dates are 1798 to 1863. They're on the cover here. We can both look. But this is the bark of Dante. And you can see the nude bodies, the grotesque, the rage, the biting, what disruptions are here from the deeper, darker, unapparent life. And I'll pass that one around too. And of course, that was also true of what the Romantics were bringing into art after the neoclassical period was, and not only in art, but the whole Romantic movement was to go under into that dark place. The poets, the artists, the writers, the whole movement of Romanticism was to honor the irrational, what did not make sense. It was a reaction against the Enlightenment and the rational move. Worldview. And actually Jericho went into an insane asylum and did paintings of some of the insane characters. Jericho is studying corpses and having severed limbs brought into his studio. There is a pull toward all of that other grisly stuff. Yes. Well, yes, we have a French Revolution. We have, all kinds of upheavals in the psyche and in history. Make it strum and drum. Is that what you say in German? All of the strum and drum. Is that what you say in German? Who's German here? Strum. How do you say it?
Strum.
All of the passion and the. Do you want to make some comments? Yeah. How do you say it? And what's the translation of it? Mm-hmm. That's what I meant. Yes. It was that. Right. It's what you feel when you look at those bodies clinging to the raft or clinging to the... Right, exactly. Exactly. Anybody want to comment? Because we're about to go into the dreams and you're working.
The idea that these people really never work, they're living in this rarefied environment, and they have time to really think about life that is unknown to, I think, Americans today. It's just not something that
works that much.
Well, I...
They had money. They never had to worry about money. They inherited $3 million in 1800s or something.
They inherited a lot of money, but I have to make...
They have a moral responsibility. I'm not saying don't have that to do something, but...
But I want to argue slightly on the other side of that. Even though there was money in the family and Henry had money, he really supported himself by his writing. And so that's much more of a dated view of Henry. It needs a little bit of a corrective. When he bought Lamb House in England on Rye Coast, he wrote like a banshee to pay for the down payment. And he did it, he really saw himself earning his living by his pen. He was very conscious of what his publishers would give him in advances, of how much he was being paid for installments in the magazines. So even though he had some money, he also lived by his efforts, and his orientation to his work was that it was his providing resource, that he wasn't a man of leisure who couldn't not work. He did his apprenticeship. He wrote for newspapers and magazines when he traveled to Europe as a young man. He was a correspondent from the newspapers, and then he started writing for the magazines. And so he really did his apprenticeship, and the first few novels that came out were kind of apprenticeship novels. It wasn't until Daisy Miller came out in the magazines that he really made a name for himself. And then he was sought after, and he published a tremendous amount. Most of his novels were serialized in the magazines first, which is how he really earned his keep. He earned money to give to Alice. When he inherited from a parent, he gave more to Alice. So there's a little truth in what you say, but there's also some truth in his identifying himself as a working artist who needed to work. And when he took on a bigger financial commitment, he needed to work more. And when he didn't make it as a success in theater, he was worried about finances. Edith Wharton arranged for the publisher to make a big advance on, may have been one of the unfinished novels of the autobiography, I've forgotten which Henry never found out about. It was her money that supported him. She tried to get up a financial collection for her 70th birthday, and he heard about it, and he scratched the whole idea. So money was a very big issue in his life in terms of being concerned about it and seeing himself as needing to support himself. But he was living a life of a gentleman. I mean, he had a house, he had servants, he traveled, he ate out, he belonged to English clubs. But he certainly didn't have the funds that Edith Wharton had. He didn't have a chauffeur and a car. I want to correct the idea that he wasn't just a man of leisure. He would write every morning. That was his job, and that's how he saw himself. That's right. Yes. That's right. Let's take about a 5-minute break, and then we'll come into the dreams. The paper that was on the desk this morning, out of the quotation from Feinstein's book, and this is the father's vision. And take a minute to look at that. And then if you want to go ahead and read the excerpt from William James's book, then we'll have them both ready to go at the same time. Yes. You can start where the print gets a little smaller. What's in quotation marks? Oh, that's the volume that the, I think is edited by William, in which William collected some of his father's writing. And this was an excerpt from the autobiography. The original source. The first vision, this is father writing.
Father.
Okay. Edited by son William, and then I took out of Feinstein's book, so I'm just like a scholar giving you the trail. Are you all through both of them? Okay. Let's look at the father's report right now. This is a experience he had in the spring of 1844. Now, Henry Sr., the father, has just taken his two young sons and his wife to England at this time when he has this experience. He has not yet chosen a vocation, so he's at a moment of vocational crisis, which is typical in this family. He is, at this time of this experience, he does not yet have a vocation or a direction in life. He has just managed to break his father's will. So the issues of will go through two generations. So he has come into significant money that is going to make him independently wealthy.
Now, will.
The father's will. The father's will had cut Henry Sr. out.
Financing the actual
the inheritance. That's right. That's right. This pattern of the grandfather, well, of the father and son having differences and the son being cut out of the will happens in two sequences in the family. And the issue of will, not in a legal sense, but the father's wishes for the son, happens through several generations in the family, which is what Feinstein is so brilliant in documenting. When this vision happens to Henry's senior, the father, he is still without vocation. He has just come into his inheritance. Henry and William, the boys, are very, very young. They were born in 42 and 43. This happens in 1844. So young family, much money, no vocation. Very theologically oriented already in his life. And that's the context in which this dream, vision, daylight hallucination comes up. In England, he's meeting with, as I mentioned, the dignitaries of the Victorian age, with Carlyle, with Tennyson, with John Stuart Mill. He's moving in that very intellectual circle, just as he had in Boston with the Transcendentalists, with Emerson, who's a very good friend of Emerson. So he's intellectually at the higher end in terms of social connections. But he's aimless and not knowing what he's going to do with all of his ruminating thoughts, which are themselves not very well focused. So that's the historical background to this dream image hallucination, in which he's sitting before the fire after dinner. You know, the old theories of dreams tied the nightmare of the dream to indigestion and what you ate. So here we have a classic pattern. He's just eaten. He's sitting beside the fire. He's alone. And something comes over him, we might say in modern terms a complex. I mean, he has a body, physical, somatic reaction, which takes him from being a gentleman of the world to a feeling of being a baby, dependent, vulnerable, infantile, wanting mommy, who's left the room, his wife, and totally shattered down to that core archetypal fear that William displayed so beautifully in that drawing. So that's what's happened to him in front of the fire. And the issue is, can I reach, can I get my wife back in the room to connect with the reality? And he's sort of frozen in the seat trying to hold himself together. And in fact, he finally reaches out and makes that connection. So you have the falling apart of the father and the father reaching for wife, mother, as his way of coming out of this crisis. You have language that is potently, blatantly religious in its imagery. The fear and trembling is right out of the scriptures. His whole way of thinking of things is influenced by religion. He's already theologically oriented, but he hasn't quite yet committed himself to the Swedenborg religion philosophy. This incident becomes for him his initiation, vestation, they call it, visitation, if you will, of something supernatural that humbles him, that makes him ready to receive the divine world word. That's the paradigm in religious terms of how he explains this experience. He, in fact, follows more of the Swedenborg philosophy. A woman suggests he reads such and such a book, and something goes on that allows him to put his life together then around this whole religious philosophy. He then becomes its spokesperson, gives lectures, writes books, publishes, has a vocation in life, even though he's not very well understood. So his life takes on a whole pattern that, in a way, this incident defines for him. Or maybe we should say his relation to this experience then defines a focus for his life. And it then becomes colored by what this sets off in him. Do you want to say anything else about this particular dream in the... Yes.
And then I had the second one. I was wondering, is there more of a connection between the woman and the father and the son?
I mean, were they? Well, Henry is more allied with the mother and tries to please her as the compliant child and her angel. And William has, as the firstborn, has the struggles with the father over vocation. Henry saw that. Well, I wouldn't know how to measure if one's stronger than the other, but the alliance or the issues with William are much more issues with the father. And the alliance and the issues with Henry are much more with his mother. And he might have learned to get out of the father's way by watching what happened to William. Or in fact, I mean, it's hard to know what prompted that. But yes, that's the way they are aligned in the family. Right. Well, the father's issues were with his father, the breaking of the will, the being cut out of the will because he was part of it. Yeah, I mean, you never have just only the father or only the mother, but. No, I'm talking the next generation up. This is a little confusing because they share so many of the same names. Henry Sr., who is the novelist's father, had his major issues with his father. Oh, okay. Ah, yes. I guess I should say the presenting problem was with the father. Yes, I totally agree. But obviously there are issues with the feminine, very much so. Yes, Michael.
So after that, the last 5 years ago, you overcame fear by overcoming fear. And then finally, your wife had overcoming fear.
Yes.
And I had to overcome
fear. Exactly. Exactly. Right. And as I said, when he leaves home to go on a lecture, he's the one who gets homesick and rushes back to home. He cannot, interestingly enough, Mary James dies before Father dies. And Father literally starves himself to death. He cannot go on without her. This is an enmeshed family. There's some quotations, if I have time, I could pull them out of the autobiography that suggest that Mary sees herself through the children, that she can't separate out from them. And in a way, the father is one of the children in needing that kind of support.
Do we have a lot of information about the father and her reaction after
she died? Some. This is what James Anderson was working on out of Chicago. Well, she was very anxious too and depended on being needed. I mean, this is talk about enmeshment and codependency. It fit her bill just perfectly. The family system works very well if you want to maintain those dependencies. And, exactly. Mm-hmm. Edith Wharton. Well, that's an interesting question. The mother's very fussy about things and trying to direct, Henry, why don't you get married? And you've paid too much for that, this sort of thing. A lot of fussing at that level. Is it what, Sidney? Oh, is it Apollonian? I'm not sure I'd apply the terms there. Mary tries to keep order in a certain way, but she does so by ignoring all kinds of realities. And if you want to argue whether that's Apollonian or not, I think we start losing the value of that Apollonian-Dionysian contrast when we take it into too many fields. It feels to me that it starts thinning out. I mean, that's... Definitely an attempt to control and to be in control, I think. Just as the children could be sick and be controlling in that way. And Feinstein does some brilliant work with the function of illness in the James family that you might want to look up. You can use your power by being an invalid in a way that you can't when you're healthy. You can control the parent. You can, your anger gets turned in on yourself. I mean, Alice did a good job of getting cancer. It fit what she needed. Something else I wanted to say and I've forgotten what it was. I don't know if this fascinates you as much as it fascinates me, all of these interrelationships. Henry calls him... Oh, I know what I want to say. Right. I would have to look at that more. When they wrote letters home, they might have been addressed to one member of the family, but they knew they were being read by all the members of the family. There's another interesting dynamic in this family I didn't mention, and that is that Mary's sister, Kate, who was widowed, early, I believe, widowed, moves into the family. So that there are two strong women in the James family as mother figures. And Kate, in a way, is much more the ramrod than Mary is. So Adele suggests that we look at, for example, the mother in The Portrait of a Lady, all of these fussing gubernatorial mothers, as carrying something of what happened with Kate and Mary in the family. And one of the unknown pieces of work in James' scholarship is really to look at Kate's influence in the family structure. There are many, many Kates throughout James' literature, too, Kate characters. What I wanted to say when you were talking about the twins and the brothers and the relation to the mother, Henry and William were very much enmeshed with each other. And one way you can tell is that when they were apart from each other, they were healthier than when they were together. When they were together, somebody would get a back problem or constipation or this ache or that ache. And if they were in the same space, house, town together, one or the other would have a symptomatic reaction. And when that one left, the other one would clear up. So they often traded symptoms, shared symptoms. Illness, as I said, has a very great presence in this family. When Henry came back, to the States to visit around 1905 and wrote The American Scene out of those trips, William, when Henry came back to Cambridge, William took off to Europe spontaneously. It didn't make any sense given William's health. When they met in Switzerland, William had come over for the water treatment. Henry had met them in Switzerland. William takes off for Italy. William goes off to Brazil to study with a famous anthropologist and comes back and Henry's there. It's just amazing how these two are so entwined with each other. Henry buys a suit made out of the cloth that William had used for his suit. All kinds of clues that Adele has been a master at picking up and interpreting. I mentioned last night, this is what you call literary psychology. You become the detective and these things begin to make sense. Henry is the junior and hated being the mere junior. When his father dies, immediately the junior drops from his name. As I say, the way of becoming a biographer with any psychological sensitivity can be a fascinating process. I think so, but I don't know. That's yet to be looked at in a detailed way. And I think a very important person in that family. This dream, Feinstein, of course, connects to Pilgrim's Progress, to Bunyan, to the whole going down and falling apart in order to be open to the revelation of God. And Father's language is very much suggestive of those parables. Just as the whole image of the prodigal son comes into play with the father's relation to the grandfather. But let's move on because we'll not get through these dreams. In the varieties of religious experience, William puts his dream in the text, only he says it belongs to a Frenchman, and he's going to freely translate it. This is not the Frenchman's experience. This is William's experience. And again, it's the same kind of core fear. It's in a crouching figure, but now the figure is somebody in the insane asylum who is tucked up under his coarse shirt. And interestingly enough, the image is that of this epileptic patient, where does he say, that's like an Egyptian cat or a Persian mummy. Somewhere, yeah. Here's a drawing that William did of an Egyptian head. You can pass that around if you want. And what I found last night from the bookseller, because I said to Louise, tell me about cats. I forgot to look up the Egyptian cat god. And this was the image, which is really the lion-headed god that had stuck with me. But of course, lions are felines too. But the cat, here's more of the cat image. So, you know, good Jungians, we would start to play with these associations. You can just pass it around and read it. Pardon me? Feminine. Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. Yes, the feminine association of the cat, which are, of course, anima issues, too, and going into that deep unconscious place. Now, interestingly enough, Henry also couches this experience in religious terms. And all his life, he's dealing with religious issues that the father introduced into his life. Well, this is Williams. I may have. Did I? It's Williams' dream, but I may have said, oh, I may.
The religious experience.
Oh, yeah, William. I'm getting confused. I think it's 1899. I'll look. No, I've got it wrong. Psychology, Principles of Psychology at the Turn of the Century. This is a little later. We'll have to. Henry read a lot of William's work, by the way. Yeah.
Did he read it prior to publication?
I think he read this one when it was published. And William read a lot of Henry's novels and was very critical. And at one point, Henry said, "Stop reading my stuff. You're not going to like it." Right. William wanted Henry to write in a certain simple way, which is not Henry's style. A lot of brother issues here. Let's go into William's dream for a minute. My sense of this is that William sees the possibility of that insane figure within himself. That it's the same kind of affective identification that we see in Henry's nightmare. And in fact, he comes out of this being much more empathic with that other creature because he realizes the bond and the closeness. So that even though there is a religious language to this dream, that he says, you know, if he didn't have this religious bearing, he didn't know what he could do with the melancholy, I still think that his relation to this figure is much more psychologically interpreted than the language leads us. In other words, he is trying to point us in the direction of a religious interpretation, but the way I read the experience for William is that he connects empathetically and that he's realizing what a fine boundary there is between the sane and the insane, that we have that potential in us, so that in fact he's more psychological than he's admitting himself to be. Do you read it that way? Do you sense? Well, my sense is that William is learning from this experience at a psychological level. That is, he's realizing that insane man is part of him, that he has that within him. I would take that to be a psychological interpretation rather than a religious statement. Even though he says at the end, you know, the eternal God is my refuge. He's couching it in religious language. My sense is that his learning from this experience has much more psychological impact than spiritual impact. I guess what I'm saying is I see the psychologist at work in here. Is that how you read it, Carl?
He says it makes you more sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling of
others. Yes. Right. But he was thrown by this experience. He was also in a depression. This also happens for him at a time when he's in a vocational crisis and conflicts with his father. So like his father, he's thrown by it and in a depression and can't sleep and eventually comes out. Is there anything else you might want to say about the brother's vision? Yes. Their dreams, right. Mm-hmm. It's just fascinating.
Both over refuge, both Henry Sr. and William, both over refuge.
And Henry doesn't use the religious context at all.
He doesn't have any of the training to defend himself against.
Right. It's fascinating. Although Henry was very young, I think under 2 years old when the father had this experience, the fact that the father took up this identification with the Swedenborg cause had an impact on Henry's life. In other words, the dream and its humbling of the father and his leading him to the word of the God, to word of God, was part of a family tradition that the boys grew up with. even though the dream itself wasn't part of his immediate, you know, something he was conscious of, the dreams, the vision's function in the father's life was part of his inheritance, as was this whole religious context, and obviously part of William's inheritance too. Let's look at the early dreams and see, we didn't get to discuss the second dream last night, which is on this sheet, and it's the bottom paragraph. And I'm just wondering what you might want to say about the parallels and the differences. Let's just stick with the first, well, we can do the first two dreams and the nightmare as well. But this was the other dream that was that he found himself in a house or shop full of furniture, huge rooms of beautiful cabinets and chairs and tables. He wandered all over the house feeling a vague, mysterious presence. At last, arriving upstairs, he found himself in a room in which an old man sitting in a chair was an old man sitting in a chair. And like the other dream, he had a sudden change from fear to strength. He called out to the man, "You're afraid of me, you coward." And the man said, "No," Henry James answered, "but you are, I know it. I see the sweat on your brow." So again, we're in rooms that are domestic interiors or full of furniture, full of artifacts. Later we're in a museum. We're in interior spaces that have objects in them. In this case, he's in a house in which he moves upstairs. What would you make of the finding the old man upstairs, knowing what you know about Henry James? What might that going upstairs signify? Well, say more. It's not downstairs in the basement. It's in Jung's dream in the autobiography. He's not going down in the cellar, down layers and layers through. He's going up. Okay. Maybe. He finds this. First of all, the vague, mysterious presence of the first dream turns out to be an old man. He's not a monster. He's an old man. Something who could teach the dreamer something, perhaps. And he's found upstairs. You want to say something about that, Louise? Could be spiritual, or except we have no indication here of religion in any way. You know how interested Henry is in the cognitive process, perhaps going into the head. What you were saying about learning something, I tend to think this is a mental, as opposed to going down under. It's a going up and out, and it's a meeting. Now, the meeting happens because he's been wandering all through the house. It's an indirect way of connecting. He's not chased away or confronted. He's not aggressively searching. He's wandering. And the wandering, in fact, leads to contact. Whereas in the nightmare and in the early dream, there's this aggressive rushing out and there is no contact. It's a shooing away. But in the second dream, the indirect wandering upstairs leads to a face-to-face contact. And the contact happens verbally, not physically through blows or chasing or, you know, if we don't know what would happen if Henry had gotten the intruder. But the interaction, the exchange, is verbal. It's through language. It's through intellect talking. And what does he say to the man? "You're afraid." So we have some of that projection going on again, because who's really afraid? And the other one says, "No." I mean, the other figure says, "No." James, the dreamer, says, "You are, I see by the sweat on your brow." No indication I'm afraid. It's all you're afraid, and I can prove it. It's all in the projection. But at least there's contact. So there's some subtle differences. We don't know which came first. We don't know if these dreams were repeated. We only know that they occurred earlier in James's life. I suspect they are his dreams, noting all the parallels. I don't think that's, you know, Lady Morrell may have picked up all kinds of conversations in her drawing room, but she made notes, and I suspect this came from James and fits certainly his psyche. Now, when we get to the nightmare, do you want to say more about what I was talking about in projection issues last night, the empowerment in the identification. Did that make sense?
That wasn't quite. I never heard that.
Ernie Rossi talks about different levels of understanding of dreams in one of his books, and he said that the I character in the dream, when he sees something happening to another character, that's kind of one level of reporting. But if the I character in the dream then also says how the I is feeling, or perhaps connected with this other character, you have a new level of self-consciousness, another level of complexity or awareness. So the first dreams are really what's happening to the character out there. The nightmare, the eye of the dream ego also says, but I'm also afraid. It's like one more level of awareness that's already mapped in the dream. Now, I don't know how you analysts would read Ernie's interpretation there. Do you? I'm throwing this back to you and those of you who are in this professionally. Would you buy what Rossi is saying, is that there's another level of awareness in the nightmare? Well, you not only project, but then you also identify how you're feeling. It's
by the projection.
Well, what's interesting about projection here, and we're going to deal with it in the short story in the Jolly Corner this afternoon, is that it's the first step sometimes in seeing what's inside if you see it outside. It's on the screen, and therefore you have the option of identifying with it or not, which is what we're going to talk about in the Jolly Corner. So in the early dreams, it's all projected. But in the nightmare, but in the nightmare, you see, he says, I in my appalled state, admitting he's afraid, must be more appalling than the appalling other. So not only is he making the connection, they're both afraid, but he must be worse off.
But I wonder if in his third account, the last one of the doctor, if in this projection, he's also afraid of not so unconscious.
Yes.
That's what I was thinking. Moving on beyond this is another step. And this is another. I don't think he's perfecting here in you're afraid of me and you're afraid. He's saying, you're afraid, that's who you are.
A part of me is afraid.
And that's a tremendous recognition. And this identification of the ego with that he's going to perfect.
If he turns around and takes all the parts of the dream as parts of himself, we don't know that he did it. Matter of fact, we have no comments on the early dreams. They were just recorded in Morel's memoirs. So what... Right. Let me say back what I think you're saying. In the second early dream, you're saying that's one step farther along than the first early dream.
Yes.
And the nightmare is one step farther along because it's saying I'm afraid and you're appalled. Both. Is that right? Well, I'm just in the order in which they appear on the sheet. The old man dream I call a second dream. The nightmare is 1910 approximately.
But I'm always achieving or doing something with you, and when it's quitting after a while, because when I get to it, I've got to go on to the dream, and I'm trying to negotiate it with myself, and I say, well, he dealt with his older man. How young he was, the older man.
It's implied in Morell's report that both of these early dreams were frightening to Henry. That both of all of these dreams were frightening experiences to Henry the dreamer. And he was not in analysis. He did see doctors along the way for back problems and what he thought was a heart condition. William had a heart condition, Henry did not, but he was certainly anxious about his health. Some of the doctors he saw had some Freudian leanings. And there have actually been reports from one of the doctors, one of the heart specialists, that said James was an anxious type. These dreams were frightening to him. Interestingly enough, he's telling Lady Morell the early dreams in about 1909, about a year and a half, before we think he had the nightmare. So even though they're from his early life, he's sharing them within a year or a year and a half of the time he has the nightmare, which suggests maybe these issues are up for him at the time of the depression.
So did his dreams progress into some more horrific kind of time?
We cannot actually document when the dreams happened. We know when they are recorded. So that it's a little tricky to argue historical development from one dream to the next. All I want to suggest is thematic connection, some discriminations you're making, Louise, about the kinds of projections that are happening. But we're in a little shaky territory to say one followed another exactly, or that his awareness progressed and that allowed him to dream more complicated dreams. These are all archetypal personal issues that his psyche is carrying, and that they come up at least in one form, in a written form, in a shared form, within a space of a few years, around the time of the major depression in his life. But I'm a little hesitant to say this dream happened before that and that provoked that. You see? Well, it's...
If they were in sequence, it would tend to think there's a development.
Right, right.
Going back to the...
Yeah, and it's shaky to do that in a biographic historical way. The material is here in the psychological, developmental, discriminating progression. But whether that's how it actually happened in his life, I don't know. So I want to back off of that. But I think what's interesting is that the dreams are presenting to us different discriminations in the issue of projection. And when we get to the late short story, but late is 1908 and this dream is 1910, you will see finer discriminations yet. So we can't lay it out neatly in his life, but we can say all of those possibilities are working and are mixed into his life. What's interesting, I think, is we will come back to this issue of empowering projection in the Jolly Corner. And what Alice carries for Spencer, because that's an issue that I think is curious, that how can somebody be empowered as he is in the story's end without fully accepting or understanding that shadow figure. In this case, the way James uses the nightmare in the autobiography, his triumph to dispel this awful figure is potent for him. It leads him into the Gallery of Apollo, which is his identification as an artist. It returns him to the childhood memories of the Louvre, which are very formative and an important place in his life. So the dream is very powerful for him. But, you know, if I were his therapist, I'd want to say, well, what's this awful character carrying in to you that you feel you have to dispel? I think there's more work to be done, and that's why the short story is so interesting, because it does the rest of the work. I will pick that up this afternoon. Yes, although as I say, the short story is published in 1908. The dream happens in 1910. All we can say are these issues in James's psyche are very much alive. In a conscious way, he's working something out, which then comes back to him in an unconscious form. And he didn't have a therapist, he did have his art. to work things through. He did have his art, but he didn't have an analyst. So we'll pick up that projection issue again. How do you feel about leaving things right now and breaking for lunch and then coming back to the fiction? Does anybody have a burning question that you want to ask right now or something I should be thinking of over lunch? Yes, zoo stuff. Yeah, but it's not only thunder and lightning, it's also water. It's also, it's raining. It's a storm. And so while you have the Zeus stuff, you also have the water. And the water image is a very potent image in the Great Good Place. Whether we'll get to it or not, I'm dropping clues because if you haven't picked up this book, which is the collection they've ordered for us, you'll find all the stories that I've referred to, the Last of the Valerii, the Great Good Place, the Beast in the Jungle, the Jolly Corner. If this group really gets enticed with James, we might be able to do other stories at another time. But this is a wonderful collection because not only does it have these stories, but it has some of the original sources that James worked with and manipulated. So it's a wonderful introduction to James. Yes? Sure.
Dad was in the metaphysical realm with other people back in the Middle Ancient Hundreds, and I was wondering if you were connected with that person.
With whom?
Who was supposed to be one of the great metaphysicians back in the era.
I don't know.
The reason I'm mentioning it was because Dad was in the metaphysical circle, possibly to talk to children the metaphysical ideas of channeling. He did say that he was a spiritual.
Right. Right. Louise brought Adele's book. You can look quickly in the index and see if you see that name. There's a new book out called The Encyclopedia of Henry James. You can look up all kinds of things. I mean, this is an inexhaustible subject. No. No, it's a storm. A great storm. Oh. And it's that storm of projection, right. The trouble is you start reading more than one story of Henry James and you borrow details from other stories. So we'll have to wait for water in the Great Good Place.
In terms of break,
okay. What I want to do is tell you a story. It's after lunch. It's rest period. We can relax a little bit. And I'm going to, by kind of talking or walking my way through this very short paper, give you an idea of how you could look at an early James short story psychologically and also focus on this question of the appalling other, the relation to the unconscious. And as I mentioned briefly this morning, there is a woman in a pivotal position to make this bridging relationship, even though she doesn't quite bring it off in this story. And then the bulk of the time we'll look together at the Jolly Corner, in which there is a woman in a mediating role who can carry off a very different kind of relation to the unconscious. The one I'm suggesting is another way of looking at the dream, another voice that doesn't have to ward off and dispel the intruder. It's a voice of acceptance. So that's my plan. Have any of you read The Last of the Valerii? Is that one of the stories you did get to or not? Okay, it's a delightful story. It's one of my favorite. It's published in 1874. It is in this collection or in the library and other volumes. Leon Adele said that it's a story which really bears testimony to the dangers of exhuming dormant primeval things, of drawing up that stuff from the buried past. I think, though, he's wrong in his interpretation of the moral of the story, which is that the past is best left buried. I'm going to argue with him about that, as we good psychologists might. It is a study of what happens when a weak ego, that is the Count, does excavate in the depths of the psyche. It's dangerous. And, in fact, he falls over because his ego isn't strong enough to hold, and he's lost in a obsessive worship of the statue of Juno. Now those are the issues we're going to look at. Is the past best left buried? what happens when you have a weak ego excavating in the depths of the psychology. Those are the questions and the problem. I'm going to tell you just a little bit about the plot so you get the feeling. In the story, there's a wealthy young American who had the air and almost the habits of a princess. Those are quotations. The countess who marries an extremely handsome Italian count, a man who touches not only her heart but her imagination. So you have a young princess, wealthy American, meeting, marrying a dark, handsome Italian count connected to his pagan roots. The story is narrated by the countess's godfather, who is himself a painter of ruins and relics. I mentioned this morning that James loved to put the story in the hands of a narrator, because then you had this refraction to the subject that made it more interesting. We're just diving right into the last of the Valerii. And did you have a chance to read that story at all? No, the last of the Valerii. This is an early story of James.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, what I've just said is that Adele identifies this story as one in which it is dangerous to unearth what is buried from the past, and I will agree with that. But he suggests the moral of the story is to leave the past buried. I will not agree with that. It is a story of a weak ego in the person of the count who explores the depths of the psyche, and it's dangerous. So that's where we've just started our discussion. And what I'm going to do is take you through the story as a way of introducing you to look at James's fiction along these lines of the theme of the appalling other. And then we'll get to the jolly corner and really work with it. But since you haven't read this one, I'm going to lead you through the process. The two main characters in this story are the Countess and the Count. And the Countess is an American princess. Princess, I mean, in quotation marks. She's been raised with certain expectations. She has money. She marries a dark, handsome Italian count who has a villa that is loaded with old goodies buried under the earth. And the story is narrated by the countess's godfather. Now, the godfather is a painter of ruins and relics. And even before the wedding, the countess-to-be begins to refurbish the count's ancestral property. She orders excavations to begin because she has a sense that there might be some more old stones and statues under the earth. So she's the one who initiates the search. The excavations are supervised, I quote, by an ugly, dwarfish man who seemed altogether a subterranean genius, an earthy gnome of the underworld. Doesn't it make your Jungian heart leap? A magnificent statue of Juno is unearthed that bestirs the count's unrestrained pagan devotion. He puts the statue in a little like garden house that looks a bit like a temple, and he goes to worship at night. The count does, the count. The more obsessively he worships the marble goddess, the more he distances himself from his own wife. The countess discovers evidence of blood sacrificed on Juno's altar. This is serious business. Don't know if it's the count's blood or not. So she eventually orders the burial. Bless you. Three times, good luck. She orders the burial of her rival, that is the stone statue, in order to restore her marriage, which has been shattered by this discovery and the count's falling away. Afterward, the count falls on his knees and buries his head in the wife's lap. That's just a quick plot of the story, but obviously condensed to the salient points, right? Now, the story ends with a very cryptic exchange, which is very fascinating. Several years after the main action takes place, the count is visited by a European who looks into his cabinet and sees a number of artifacts. And he sees this marble hand, which is from the Juno, he doesn't know that, suspended in the corner of the cabinet. And he says, he asks the count, what is it? And the count says, it's the hand of a beautiful creature whom I once greatly admired. Ah, a Roman, says the gentleman with a smirk. A Greek, says the count with a frown. This is how the tale ends. Somewhat cryptically, something about a distinction between this Juno, whether it's a Roman Hera or whether it's a Roman Juno or a Greek Hera. I'm suggesting that these sketchy clues are already giving us hints. And the question I would raise is, what's the difference between the Greek and the Roman? Or what's the significance of describing the excavator as a dwarfish man, an underworld figure? What do you imagine the count would lose burying, having the statue buried, as well as what he might gain when he returns to his modern wife? And this is how I practice this job of literary scholarship. My ears are perked to the good questions or details, particularly if it's mythological association. And the wonderful thing about working with this story is nobody's done it the way I started to do it, so that's also a kick. A few people mention this dwarfish man, but not in the way it seems so obvious to me in a Jungian sense. Now, this story sets up a real dilemma. It's an either-or situation. Either the Count has his Juno and is obsessed by a pagan worship by moonlight and ignores his wife, or the statue is buried and he returns to his wife. The story sets up that dichotomy. It's either worshiping the Juno and sacrificing the marriage, or sacrificing the Juno and having the marriage. I think that's a limitation of the story, that it is such an either-or situation. But clearly James didn't have an option at that time in his own psyche, imaginative process, to create another relationship to what was deeply buried. Also, the Count as a character did not have the psychic strength, we'll say, or the symbolic ability to bridge for himself. That'll be a little clearer as I go on. The narrator throughout remains confused about the Count's personality. Remember, the narrator is the godfather of the daughter. He's a painter. But I will suggest the story has more to say than the narrator understands, which is very true of James. Now, unlike previous interpretations, what I'm going to do with the story is not ally myself with the narrator. I'm going to step back from his position and suggest that he, too, is somewhat limited. Now, a painter translates three-dimensional reality into a two-dimensional surface. That's what he does, to try to, again, create the illusion of a three-dimensional space, usually, or the more traditional painters. James is always interested in the depth. So, interestingly enough, we have a narrator who now is a master at creating a two-dimensional reality, the illusion of depth. But I'm suggesting that this story is really exploring the potency of depth. The narrator and the Count, you can see them as defining different positions with respect to the buried past. The Count, when the statue is unearthed, falls literally over prostrate in this pagan worship. I mean, it does happen over a period of time, but he falls into this worship, which becomes obsessive, such that he loses connection with his wife. The narrator remains at much more of a distance from this object and whatever it represents. So you have immediately two positions with respect to Juno and what she represents symbolically. The Count, who falls into the obsession, the narrator, who stands back and sees this guy as crazy. You see a pattern here, two different positions. The Countess is in the middle. She is both wife and goddaughter,